Welcome to A Penny for Your Thoughts, a podcast brought to you by Sean Blumgren and Andrew Penny from Central Iowa. On our podcast, we discuss all things agronomy, high yield management, and give you real-time updates on what we're seeing and hearing from the field. We will also gain insight from industry professionals as we bring you relevant and timely information on current agronomic practices. Please give our podcast a five-star rating and follow us on Twitter at SciPathology and at Sean Blumgren. You can also email us with questions or ideas for the show, apennyforyourthoughts@gmail.com. That's apenny4yourthoughts@gmail.com. Thank you always for joining us. These are always some of my favorite episodes to record, and it's when we get to bring somebody back that's either done an episode or joined us on an agronomy edition, and
whether they wanted to come back or not.
Yeah, right? Yeah, they didn't know they were having that audition. So, Andrew, go ahead and introduce our guest today.
Yeah, so man, this is a perfect time to have this guest on. He's one of the foremost soybean experts, trying to coin the term and maybe copyright it, soybean belt. But yeah, happy to have Dr. Sean Castile on from University of Purdue. Sean, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Andrew and Sean. I appreciate the opportunity, and we'll see how much I appreciate it after the recording.
We love to have people on that have done really great research, and super excited to dive into the conversation. But I guess, Dr. Castile, there's most of our listeners will have heard you on our agronomy series we did, but I guess brief background on where you're from, where you went to school, how you ended up at Purdue.
Yep. So I'm an East Central Illinois farm boy. So I grew up with corn and soybeans, grew up on flat black soil, and did graduate work out of the state. So I did undergrad at U of I and then went down to the South. So I was down at North Carolina State for a number of years with graduate degrees and cotton. Learned a lot about cotton, did a couple of years of fertility work and recommendations at the state level, and then got a PhD in soil fertility and nutrient management, and came back to the Midwest at Purdue, and been here enjoying time as a soybean specialist.
Nice. Well, before I let Sean do his usual bit, yeah, I gotta say, I was talking to my friend, mentor, and fellow soybean lover, Dr. Darren Mueller from Iowa State, and he told me he told me to tell you hi. It sounds like you guys work together in Illinois.
We did. I was his lackey. In other words, work together is loose. He was the one that, you know, told me what to do. And as long that was actually him and Carl Bradley, so another soybean pathologist. You know, I was in Wayne Peterson's lab, and so I was the one doing all the work for him, and then giving them the break, like the break they needed to think clearly. And that break was, Sean, we need to play some ping pong. We need a mental break. And so I fell on the sword for him.
Is Darren good at ping pong?
He is. He's very good.
He is. Wow.
Yeah, we used to actually have some battles back when I was in his lab still. We would have some battles, and then Yuba, his old statistician guru, we had some pretty serious ping pong matches.
There might be another t-shirt in the works. So, Sean, we start our show. We have a question we love to ask. So obviously today we're going to talk about some of your research and soybeans. But I guess thinking about just where we are this moment in time, what has you really excited in agriculture?
You know, I think the big thing with agriculture in my world is how much people are really putting effort into soybeans. Again, growing up in Illinois, you know, it was soybeans were second, corn was first. And that mentality has definitely changed over the last, you know, probably 5 years, 10 years for certain last 5 years. But I think people are excited about soybeans. I think there's a lot of upside to that, and people are managing for that and seeing the benefits of that. If you look at, you know, Indiana, and we're breaking records in 2018, 2020, 2021, and 2023 in terms of yields. And so I think people are really excited about what they can do with this crop.
Yeah, I love that, because I think we're really starting to see that, you know, the old days of kind of the, you know, soybeans are just a cover crop or whatever, a rotational crop. Right. It definitely seems like a lot of the work that you and people like you are doing are showing us what we're capable of if we do it the right way. So let's dive into it. I guess, Andrew, set the stage for what we're going to talk about today, a slight deviation from our normal segment. So tell our listeners kind of how we've got this set up, and then we'll dive in.
Yeah, I think Sean gave a perfect description and kind of the reason I wanted to deviate from what we typically do, you know, talking about the science of a subject and then the management portion. You know, with Sean's experience and background, I thought it'd be good to discuss some of his research because, you know, as we try and advance soybean production and some of those management practices to match up more with corn, he's done a lot of research looking at, you know, using high-speed planters to plant soybeans, digital imagery to look at soybeans and you know, try and make prediction models, try and use the reflectance data to do so. And so I think there's a lot of cool stuff that he's done with soybeans that as we try and progress in those management practices, you know, I think he'll have some good insight on what we can do to further that step. So I figured we'd first start, you know, I think one of the things that I continuously try and talk to growers about is doing more in soybeans, right? We do so much to corn. What if we were to do that in soybeans? What if we were to focus on the singulation, planting depth, starter fertilizer, you know, all that stuff with soybeans? And so I figured we'd start with this high-speed planter research that you've done. So tell us a little bit about this research that you did and what your end goal was.
Yeah, so this came out a number of years ago when John Deere was really coming on the scene with their high-speed planter ExactEmerge and got a great working relationship with John Deere and the folks there, and you know, other outfits have come out with their versions of this, but we started with John Deere and their ExactEmerge, and the concept was, okay, we've seen it in corn, what can we do in soybeans? And that's where we started. And the idea with it is, okay, it's one thing to go fast, but for what purpose? And so with this, you know, the big play that we've got, and maybe answering some other questions to come, is we want to plant soybeans timely. And so these windows that we get are very, very short. And I think that's different than what I grew up with. And these windows are, you know, we've got the technology to go 24/7, whether we should, you know, that's another thing. Yeah. But one aspect of that is, you know, this planting speed, the technology has allowed us to do that. And so we can get out in a hurry. And I really want to see how well did these planters perform in allowing us to get out timely with these beans.
Yeah. So with that, how many treatments, you know, thinking about all the different treatments you could have in a study like this, what were the treatments that you had in this trial? You know, was it different populations, different row units? What did you look
at? Yeah, so this was field scale. So let's start there. This is field scale work. And so working with the 24 row planter and tractors to match up to it. And within that space, we had planting speeds of 5, 7.5, and 10. And then one year we were able to push it even a little bit more because we had the space. So we went up to 12.5 in that year. And space, when you do field scale research and you're at 24 rows at a time and doing yield monitors, you eat up a lot of land in a hurry. So you need a runway. So we're able to do that. Plus, you need the runway to start and you need the runway to shut down. You have the parachute to come out the drag strip, right? to come back and slow it down. But we also did that with seeding rates too. And so for a couple of years, we did, I believe, 90,000 and 130,000 on these 30-inch rows. And then in another year, we went up to 170,000. And the concept was not that we needed those higher seed rates to yield, but we were trying to really evaluate the performance of the equipment. And so in other words, when you're running a 30-inch planter, seed spacing is totally different than when you're running a 15 or 20, right? Ideally, I would love to add a 20. That would be more representative of a planting situation that I want with soybeans. I don't necessarily want 30s. I know Iowa tends to have a lot more than we do. But if I could get a 20 or a 15-inch planter, that would have been a better setup. So yeah. My way of getting around that was to do different seed rates to simulate the seed-to-seed placement in a row on what would be more of a normal, narrow row.
Yeah. Well, thinking about that too, you know, you mentioned some of the populations. When we have these high-speed planters, you know, it's not always a situation where you have to go faster because of the weather conditions or you have to cover so many acres. Sometimes it's just the fact that you can go faster, whether or not, kind of like you mentioned, whether or not you should or not. what were the speeds you looked at?
Yep. So the speeds, again, so you think about a traditional setup of around 5-6 mile an hour. So that was our starting point, was 5. And then we went up to 7.5, 10. And then in another year, we had enough space to go to 12.5. So again, you're flat mode docking. And so when you're changing speeds, I tell you what, I still remember watching the grass grow on 5 mile an hour when you just got done doing 10. Yeah. Even 7.5, it was like night and day what you're doing and how much ground you're covering.
Yeah. I can only imagine doing those speeds. Anybody that would have a father or a grandpa in their farming operation trying to go 10 mile an hour compared to what they're used to historically.
It's yeah.
They're like, whoa.
Yeah, we're going to road gear is what they would say, right?
Yeah, great.
That's what we're doing. And then throw, let's see, if I recall, two of the 3 years we were in no-till, so you got road cleaners going. You swear you had a snowplow going through.
Yeah. Flinging stuff out. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a side note, but you think about that. So above the screen that we're interviewing Dr. Castile, and I can see my grandpa and my father, there's pictures up there. And I think about Grandpa Bob jumping in a planter and being told he's going to go 12 and a half miles an hour. He'd look at you like you were crazy. But talk a little bit about the evaluation and taking notes on those trials. So what factors were you looking at? Emergence, plants, plant heights,
right?
All that
stuff. Yeah. So within all of that, we're using the plants as an indicator. We did not do any open seed slots to look at seed placement. And at that time we didn't have the technology to, you know, kind of count them in the seed slot itself. Now you think about GoPros and everything else that's available. We probably could have done that. So we use emergence to indicate variability, uniformity, all these indices. There's a bunch of fancy ways of looking at it, but in short, it's about, okay, uniform emergence or the timing of emergence and the singulation and how well is it plant to plant available space. There's a lot of these engineering type indices that we use. So that's what we looked at. And in particular, we also tracked it on a daily basis to catch emergence rates. So not only variability and uniformity, but was there variability and emergence rates? And so we did that on a daily basis up until everything was emerged. And then we followed that later in development and ultimately yield as well.
Yeah. So are you looking at, obviously in corn, we put a huge emphasis on space between plants and that sort of thing. You know, singulation, doubles. I hope I'm not saying something that's incorrect, but it seems like traditionally we don't put the same emphasis on that in soybeans. So did you evaluate that, I guess, seed to seed spacing?
Yeah. We did definitely all of that. And so this is where it comes into the tricky part with soybeans and in comparison to corn. So let's think about corn on 30 inch rows. You're doing 30,000, 35,000 plant pop, right? And now you're add another 100,000 to that is what we're talking about. And so the idea of having corn that's every 6 inches or whatever the number is, now we're talking soybeans that are every 1.6 inches, right? And so to catch that variability, again, that's why I started cutting rates. And again, that's where I'd love to get into 15 or 20s, because let's just think about it. If we're doing a 30 inch planter at 90,000, you have a seed every 2.3 inches, right? I went and did the math to do my homework, so I had this exact number for you. So I knew I wouldn't remember those. But then if we were to do a traditional 15-inch row at 140,000 seed rate, that's every 3 inches. So now you can see we're 50% greater area, and so then this plant-to-plant or seed-to-seed variability really plays in when you have the rows come closer, right? Yeah. Because now you have down the road, there's more spacing.
Yeah, it's hard not to want to like jump to the other end of the conversation and talk about the philosophy of, you know, low pop versus high pop, but we're sticking to the script.
Yeah.
Right.
So
I can go off script. Don't worry about that.
We're good at that sometimes.
I guess kind of tying into that, you know, and maybe this is a whole another episode in its own, which it probably is, but do you have a rough idea? You know, what do we see before we get into the soybean results? What do we see with corn, you know, looking at these high speed planters, you know, whether you're going fast or slow, what's the impact?
Yeah, in terms of corn, I think of the two crops, corn's probably going to be the one that is definitely more responsive and one that you have to be in tune with on that one. And so that's where, I mean, if you don't have uniform emergence, that's one that you really think about playing out more in the corn world. I don't have them memorized. I was trying to actually go back as we're talking on this one, but I know that there was some work done early before the high-speed planters themselves and the mechanisms were available, and that variability, because it just couldn't perform, really had drastic effects on corn yield because of uniform emergence and spacing. Whereas now the technology is there, whether it's exact emerge or any of the other colors of equipment, they can perform well in doing the seed spacing. And so from what I can tell, again, I haven't done thorough research on the corn side, but I think that the equipment is there to be able to get us in a place where we can still do decent seeding and uniform emergence at these rates of speed.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's go into the results.
Yeah, let me ask one question, and I might have missed it. I apologize. So you mentioned Xactimerge and then other colors. Were you primarily looking at one specific line here, or what?
Yeah. So this is, I do this too often. I do bootstrap research. I get a few ideas and I just run with it. Yeah. And so I had a good relationship with deer, and I'd be welcome to do it with anyone else, but it just happened to be with deer.
Perfect.
It was just on the side. They had it. I said, hey, let's do it. And that's what we did.
Gotcha.
And then too, you didn't compare. So this was just looking at a high speed planner alone. This wasn't comparing to a normal, say, finger pickup or.
Yep, exactly. Okay. Awesome. You know, all those things would have been wonderful, but no, this is just the new technology compared to itself versus seed rates and speeds.
Gotcha. So, great segue. How did speed impact emergence?
So here's the real takeaway for me on this study is, speed, it performed well. Again, you got to put the caveats of we're planting on 30-inch rows. And that seed is so close together, and it's with a crop that can adapt, right? So Let's put all of that together, right? So even if we did have, and there was some slight variations in uniformity in terms of plant-to-plant spacing or seed-to-seed spacing, ultimately in terms of yield, it doesn't really make a big difference because you look at our seed rates, what, we're 90,000 to 170,000. There shouldn't be any difference. You go to any seed rate trial in soybeans, you shouldn't see a bit of difference unless you've got field that has white mold per se, right? You have those higher pops and you have a condition that's going to be conducive to disease. So put all that into context, right? The yields and everything else really weren't affected, wasn't negative. So it looks like, hey, there's a great opportunity. If you want to run a high speed planter in soybeans, it looks like it's performing well. Uniformity is good enough for soybeans in particular. The one that did catch my eye was emergence rates. And so this was lesson learned after the fact is that we tended to have faster emergence with the faster planting. Now, that doesn't mean that, okay, that's always going to be the case. So I always want to go back. Why was that? I go back to, if you actually pulled the paper, I think you can probably even see a few pictures we put up there, and I've got more videos on this, the snowplow effect. And what was occurring is I believe that the higher speeds, we were throwing so much residue and soil that the actual seed depth was more shallow, right? It was shallower. So then, and we had enough soil moisture, enough rainfall that we weren't hurt by that. So it stands to reason you got 1 inch planted versus an inch and a half or whatever the actual scenario was, adequate soil moisture, boy, those beans are going to be out of the ground faster. So that's the thing that happened on that study. And that was with row cleaners that were static. They weren't adjustable in terms of on the fly. So if we're looking at new technology now, I think that's a key that people need to make sure that they have row cleaners that are adjusting on the fly, quite literally, to these conditions.
Yeah. So here's a question regarding the speed and the impact of planting depth and seed spacing, and I would say more importantly, planting depth. And I ask that because historically, whether a grower's using an old Kinsey split planter or just using a drill, as long as the seed's on the seed could be on the soil surface, and like, oh, it's fine, it'll germinate and grow. What was the impact on planting depth with speed? And I ask that because what's your take on how important planting depth is in soybeans?
That's a good question.
Yeah. So again, the faster speed, I think that the seed depth was actually less or more shallow. Yep. And again, I think that we're taking more residue away and some soil. I think there's that part of it. These did have an airbag system on it. So static down pressure on that. But you think about new technology, and here's the case where I think you're planting faster. You've got technology that can adjust for row cleaners. You have technology, if it's a delta force or whatever it is, for active down pressure. I think that's where this is going to come into a different storyline than our results, because, okay, yeah, we had good technology, but not the greatest in terms of row cleaner active changing, and same thing with down pressure. So I think that's going to be the one that, if anyone's getting into this or have been getting into, that's where we need to manage that better.
Yep.
In terms of, I want to address your comment about row cleaner about a drill or Kinsey or anything else. I want seeds to have a good soil to seed contact. Yes, soybeans grow in a gravel lot as long as you have what?
Moisture.
Water, right? Yeah.
Yep.
And so when that turns off, you get screwed, right? And so I don't like the idea of dusting in soybeans. So let's go on and make this one very clear, right? I want a good soil to seed contact. And so again, if you're running into the drill, let's go to the worst case scenario, right? When I grew up, I had the drill on our farm for a number of years, and I knew when I was setting it right and when I wasn't. When I didn't see any seed on top of the ground, I knew I didn't set that drill right because it was too deep, right? You know that you're going to have those Goldilocks effects. You're going to have a drill. You need to have a little bit on top of the ground. So then you got most of them where you want, anywhere that inch to inch and a half. And then you got some that are down to 3 inches. So that's understanding the ball game with the drill. And know you have to have a higher seed rate.
Yep.
If you're running a Kinzie type planter or any other, the older technology without having the high speed, I still think as long as we're an inch and a half, give or take a quarter of an inch, that's a good spot for us. Okay. There's going to be some that like it shallower. I particularly like it around an inch and a half so that there's some level of protection from early spring temperature swings. I want to have good soil moisture so we do get adequate germination uniformly as we can and get good emergence. And then I go back into the June period because whenever we start to turn dry and we're drying out in the upper inch of soil, inch and a half of soil, right where those roots were is where our nodules are. And so if we turn off dry there and we get some heat to it, those nodules, nitrogen fixation is actually starts to get compromised. Yep. So that's another reason I look to, I want at least an inch and a half, usually in most of my cases.
Well, this is slight bunny trail. We've had a couple excessively dry springs the last 2 or 3 years. What's the deepest you'll go chasing moisture? Because I feel like for what we've struggled with is the guys around here that start maybe your term that I'm going to steal, the timely planted soybeans instead of early planted soybeans. Seems like we're having adequate moisture in like mid to late April, but by early May, we may really start to see that topsoil dry up. So how deep are you willing to go?
Right. I think a lot of that comes down to the field condition itself. And so what I mean by that is it a no-till? Is it a VT? Is it a strip? All right. Put those into context. Soil texture has to come into this. And then how are you setting the planter after the fact, right? If you're chasing after the moisture, let's say the moisture is at 2.5. That's pretty deep. I've seen beans do it. I've done demo plots. I've set the planter as deep as they could go, as much down pressure, and it'll eventually come out of a 3-inch seeded depth, but that's not ideal, right? And so if you got a soil that tends to be tight, boy, I don't want to go much beyond an inch and a 3/4 maybe, right? But if you've got a soil that's a little looser and you're doing a good job of not doing too much down pressure, because I've seen that where you've got so much down pressure and then you've got those gauge wells that are compacting that, then you might even get some smearing on the side. That's not a good recipe there. So I'd still, 2 inches can work. I don't always recommend that. Again, not knowing the fields themselves, but I think about understand how are they going to emerge out of that condition. If it's, I think calendar has to put in this too. If you've got soils that are dry and you've got a calendar and a weather forecast that has continued to be dry, you're not going to get the rain. You can probably come out of that 2-inch okay. If you've got a recipe for rain in the next 7 to 10 days, I'd probably still just put it in an inch and a half dry soil and let the rain get you up.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Yeah, that's good info. What was the impact? You know, I read that paper and you mentioned the percent harvest plant stand. What was the impact of those treatments, speed, all of the factors you looked at on percent harvest plant stand?
In terms of any major differences between these, I really didn't see much of a difference, right? The only thing that was coming into was more of the emergence rate. I think I made that comment already. The higher speeds were leaning us toward faster emergence rates, but in the end, they kind of leveled off, and harvest stands and early season stands were pretty uniform between the treatments.
Yep. So the $1 million question, did the high-speed planter have a yield impact?
For the most part, no. There was one case, and really couldn't explain. There's one case where we had a little faster speed, and it actually yielded a little bit more, but it wasn't the fastest speed. So it's kind of one of those anomalies that occur, right? This is 3 years of data, just one field each year. So not a huge data set. I mean, they're large scale, a lot going at it. But I think the big answer of this is that we didn't have any detriment to yield in terms of fast planting speed. So again, put us in a ball game of planting timely, getting out there when we want on a calendar date or the field conditions. And it seems like a good win. If you don't have a lot of time or you got a lot of fields and cover ground, this seems like a good opportunity.
I really like that. And I think when we talk about, so I feel like largely by the influence of the research guys like you are doing, have really tried to promote this concept of let's go a little bit earlier. You know, let's not prioritize all of our corn before we even consider soybeans. And so knowing that, I think can encourage growers, hey, if we can speed that, you know, you think about doubling your speed and not having a negative impact is pretty significant in helping you guys think.
Maybe
a couple days of timely planted soybeans is easier to incorporate at that point.
Right. Yep. And I think whenever people are making this decision on this type of equipment, you know, whether it goes across both crops. And again, I already gave you my 2 cents on, I'd rather have a 20 or 15 inch row soybean instead of 30. And I'm not saying that corn has to be 20s or anything else, but boy, if you're putting an investment in a high speed planter, red, green, blue, whatever it is, orange, I don't care, pink, you got to have a system that works for both crops. And so if you do a 20, and not to say that corn needs it, but then you've got a machine that's going to plant both crops quickly, and you know, soybeans get the benefit of an RRO and timely planting. Yeah. That seems like a win to me.
What if we push the thing to 15 miles an hour and then come back and create 15 inch rows?
It's like 230s.
Yeah.
Yeah, he'd get a lot of growers
just,
on that.
Just move your
yeah. Yeah.
Just double plant the field. It works with alfalfa.
Yeah. So. I grew up in a small farm, and so we did our own testing, and we had an old John Deere 7000. We were playing around with twin row corn on our own. So with the exact thing we did.
There you go.
That's hilarious.
So building on this, you know, again, I feel like in Iowa and a lot of growers probably have a corn planter and a bean planter, mm-hmm. right? So building on this, do you see there to be any advantage as we try and advance our technology in soybean management? Do you see any advantage to using some of these new high-speed planters, or not necessarily the high-speed planters, but the new metering systems that are available in soybeans?
Yeah, I think the big thing on soybean is get the technology that allows you to plant timely. And so if you are strapped, as your farm is strapped, to cover the acres that they need in a timely fashion, high speed planting is a good option. I think the technology's there. I'm making the assumption on some of these other pieces of equipment that I have not evaluated. That seems like a really good play. And if you're able to get at least into a modified narrow, so like a 20, to get that narrow benefit too. Now, I will be quick to say 30 inch beans can yield well if they're planting earlier, but I still like, give me a little bit more narrow row. Give me a 20 or 15 to get that full benefit. Yeah. The other technology that's been coming out in recent years on planters, I really like the idea of, okay, the stand establishment, what can we do to improve that? And so I think a big part of that can be, I alluded to this on our study, is that if we had some of the active down pressure and we've got some of these conditions on a row to row that are causing issues. You can even go with, you know, the older planters that you referenced, Andrew, this idea, okay, you know, you got drive tires on 20 inch or 15 inch row beans that need a little bit more down pressure. So then you can get uniform stand emergence. And so getting anything to help with that uniform good stand emergence and establishment, I think is critical.
Yeah. Well, that's a good transition to the next topic for part one. Thinking about starting the conversation of digital imagery. And so you've done some pretty cool research, and we'll talk about both those. But I'd say let's start, you know, you did some work to try and help the breeding process within soybeans. And you guys, in your research, you took digital imagery of the crop canopy to try and forecast or tell any varietal differences with, you know, breeding lines that you looked at within this trial. So tell me about this research, you know, what you all did, kind of what your end goals were.
Yeah, so this is, I worked in combination with our breeder and breeders across the country. They had created the soy NAM population. It's just, again, without getting into the weeds of it, and again, I don't know all the particulars, but it's an associated population where they can do the tracking and where are yield gains, where are traits that are different, and so such a population of germplasm that you can investigate in a pretty wild way. And so then you bring in some agronomic folks like myself and say, okay, we talk a lot about canopy closure. And we talk about this idea of, okay, how can we maximize yield? And, you know, my cutesy saying is green to the eye by the 4th of July, right?
Yeah, you know, there you go.
A transition away from grandpa's knee high by the 4th of July corn, right? And then the idea that, yeah, the canopy closed. Well, is there varieties or is there germplasm that really capitalizes on that early growth? And so, That's kind of the premise of the study. And as we got into it and, you know, advising the student on this one, you know, we had been taking, this is old school before drones were really in vogue, but, you know, taking digital pictures of just on a monopod, same angle, and then doing canopy or brute force, right, before machine learning, all this stuff. You know, what's the canopy and how many green pixels versus the ground, and do that on a growth habit basis. And then started to associate that with some active reflectance. So you think about some Green Seeker and some of those older, you know, technologies, can there be some associations with canopy closure rates? And that's what we were doing.
Yeah. So help our listeners understand, why is it important to understand that canopy reaction and growth pattern?
Right. So the idea in soybeans is that we want to be harvesting sunlight by the time that we're flowering out the top, right? And so to put that, my cutesy sayings in context to physiology and agronomic soundness, it's the idea that we're closing the row by the 4th of July. Most of us in the Midwest, is if we're end of June, early July, that's, we're going to be R1, R2. And that should be closed. So we're harvesting that sunlight. We're maximizing as much sunlight as we can capture and translate that into, translocate that to the developing flowers and pods. So then you can make some money with that, right? And then you also have a good amount of plant sugars for overall biomass growth and this nice comparison, right? And so we can do that with timely planting. We can do some of that manipulation with row spacings and seeding. Well, you also want to know, what does this germplasm, these varieties, have in terms of their capacity? Do we have some that are fast growers early on? Can they canopy faster? Do they have smaller leaves that are more lanceolate or more the broad ones, but they're broad and they shade the lower plant? So all, a lower part of the plant. So that's the idea, is harvest sunlight uniformly through the canopy as quickly as we can.
Mm. Yeah.
Whenever we have these conversations, it always spurs on different questions. Yeah, I start thinking about a whole bunch of things, but talk a little bit about the equipment that you use to do this research.
Yeah. So the brute force way where we started was a simple digital camera, right? And we had a number of ways of creating a mask when we take the picture at each plot, come back and do this work of, okay, what's green pixel versus ground area? And then a simple percentage, right? That's kind of where it was. If you want to look at anything that's like app-based now, there's a number of apps out there that you can actually do it on the fly. I think out of Oklahoma State, Canepio, I always mispronounce it, but that's a really good app. I like to use it in terms of just taking, what's the canopy right now? I can estimate, but boy, I can already take a picture and then within a second to know what's the percent coverage. Those are really good tools that are out there now. And then other tools that we used in terms of Crop Circle, Green Seeker, this active reflectance imagery, we kind of put that in context as well. To say, okay, can we have some loose associations with whether it's canopy closure, biomass, and then put that in together as, okay, is it a one and done, or do we need to do it over time? And with this study, if I recall, I think we end up having to do a little bit more growth rates, so more over time to see what those look like.
Yeah. So thinking, you know, discussing the results of this trial, what did your research show in terms of canopy structure and the growth of development of these different varieties that you guys looked at?
Yeah, so the breeders did a great job in creating a diverse germplasm with this. And so that's the key in this, is they've got the ability to have a good background with it, so they can go with the genetic pedigree, if you will, and even genes if they want to get to that level with some of this that they have, as well as the diversity. Okay, there was a strong diversity in terms of leaf orientation and canopy. And so they were able to put that together with the rates of canopy closure and some of this to say this was related to yield. And so they started using that, and the breeders have started using this idea. I think they coined it in terms of average canopy closure. And so they did multiple readings and say, okay, early on, we know this has a really good canopy closure rate. This is probably going to be a variety on a select for. Ultimately, they're still using the combine at the end of the season with that yield. But I think this combination has allowed them to maybe fast track some of their selections. They've brought this to the next level in terms of using drones, right? This can be an RGB type situation. They can do a multi-spec or even hyperspectral, right, to use the same concept now with drones, and that's fairly commonplace with a lot of these breeders.
Yeah.
it's fascinating to think about the rate of gain with the amount of information we're able to collect. So, you know, I think about, you refer to the, you know, the monopod, but going out and taking individual plant pictures.
Oh, yes. I mean, it was brute force.
Oh, man. And the level of work to do that. And then
thank God our micro USB cards have gone from like gigabytes. Now you can get.
but I think about like just the inherent, the discipline that you'd have to even have that data to be relevant, right? What are the clouds like? Where's the light at? Are you shading it? I mean, and so the rate of advancement as we can use some of this technology is pretty fascinating. Yeah. Dr. Castile, you did research using digital imagery, specifically looking at reflectance data to try and create a yield prediction model. Tell us a little bit about that research.
Yeah. So, there's a number of us within the agronomy world of soybeans that, you know, we do a number of samplings and reflectance and had some studies of old and did that to say, okay, what's growth rates? And so trying to say, is there a level of prediction? Soybeans can be a frustrating crop in this regard. Okay. And what I mean by this is, maybe I'll pose it back to you guys, ask you guys a question.
Sean, I don't know what you're talking about. I can walk in a soybean field and I can always get within 2 to 3 bushel of what that crop's going to yield every time.
Yeah, I bet you can. So go back to your plant physiology days, right? And how many layers of leaves of soybeans do you need to maximize yield?
Oh boy, are you trying to tie in like leaf area index and all that?
Exactly.
Yeah. I forgot what that magic number is, but I know what you're talking about.
That's good. As long as you falter a little bit now, this gives me an idea. I can falter later.
Sean lives for these moments too, I feel like.
Yeah.
He's got a checkbook of or a notebook of marks when I get either flustered or don't have an answer.
Yeah. We got to work on Andrew's just confidently make up an answer and run forward with it as if you know it. We can always correct it later, but
that's right. You can edit that out. No, this idea, I told the Andrew and Sean for the audience here that I feel like I'm preparing for a defense again, and I haven't had to do that in a while. No, the idea of leaf area index on soybeans, you talk about this is going to be a science talk. No, I go back to management every time, guys. So this idea that, you know, how much biomass do we need to maximize yield of soybeans, right? Timely planting is going to get us in a case where we have a nice compact plant. And soybeans, in terms of this leaf area index, the number of layers, we can go upwards of 5 or 6 or even 7 layers of leaves per ground area, right? So if you had 1 square foot of ground area, you could have 7 to 8 layers of leaves over that same ground area. And that's not to say that's what you need, right? And the question is, what do you need to maximize yield? And in most cases, if you've got, again, I'm using the Midwest as my proxy on this, for a 3.5 to 4.5 leaf area per ground area, that's more than enough to maximize. And so, but knowing that we can go up to 6 or 7 leaf area compared to ground area, that's where it gets really frustrating. Again, on your question, Sean, of, okay, how are you predicting yield with this canopy reflectance? Because canopy reflectance has a good associations with biomass and has a good association with leaf area index in some cases, or more NDVI. And that's a really strong relationship when you look at that other crop, corn, right? Biomass and yield, I mean, that relationship is really strong. And yes, we can increase yield with more biomass in soybeans, but that relationship is not quite as tight as it is in corn. I think it's more this growth rate is the one that I look at more on soybeans than I do biomass.
Yeah. So building on that, you kind of ties in perfectly with the next question. You kind of reminded me of, you know, my old crop phys days. And you know, so you're measuring reflectance. And I think about the fluorescence meters and some of the work I've done looking at, you know, measuring photosystem 2 and just photosynthesis. What does reflectance tell us about the health of a crop canopy or just about the crop canopy in general?
Right. So when you look at reflectance in terms of the visual spectrum, right, you know, we're talking about a multi-spec type imagery versus hyperspect, right? And again, not to get into too much of the weeds, but a little bit of this, you know, what we see in terms of a green plant, okay, that reflectance is, okay, we see a green plant because it's healthy and that's what it's reflecting versus what it's absorbing, right? And you think about, you know, the different bandwidths of sunlight and photosynthetically active radiation, right? That's what we're harvesting. I say it usually as sunlight, But this idea of, okay, what's being absorbed and used to create plant sugars and then what's being reflected. And so whenever we have a stressed plant, right, you think about what's being reflected is more of this off green or yellow as an example versus, okay, we're absorbing the wavelengths that we need for good photosynthetic capacity. And now we end up having reflectance of green tissue, which is good, right? That association with good. So that's what we're talking about. What's actually being absorbed and then to be used versus what's being reflected to show either stress or health of a plant.
So this is incredibly complex. I think that's obvious as we go through this, but talk a little bit about the results of your studies. So you've done these studies. We're trying to build these models. What is being done, I guess, to help us get to the point where that we can accurately predict the yield? Tell us about the study in that.
Yeah, so I think the one you're referring to is multi-state, multi-study in terms of different germplasm that we had from old to new varieties. It was one of the ones that I first started with some of the other soybean agronomists, and it was just fascinating to study to have soybeans from the 1920s to present. And so you think about how plant structures changed over those years and the way they look in terms of leaf shape, canopy, all the yield advancement within there. So we used a lot of that data to build this data set. And so, you know, there was an improvement in terms of some of these reflectance and how those were associated with yield. And the point I want to make with this study in particular is that drastic yield swings, and we saw a lot of that in reflectance. Reflectance refers to plant health in a loose way in DVI, the vegetative indices, right? And so other aspects that have come out after the study is also looking at the nutrient concentration. So in particular, what I'm driving at with this is that we had a very strong relationship, not in this study, but it goes in line with this. So if you have good vegetative indice, right, if you think about NDVI, most people say, okay, if I've got a strong, healthy looking plant, my NDVI is high, right? And there's some good relationships with biomass. Well, there's also good relationships with, again, let's use that other crop. Use an NDVI for nitrogen rate, right? And responsiveness or active, right? And so these newer lines, higher yielding lines as well, had more nitrogen, right? They had more sulfur. And so there was a really nice relationship with reflectance, I think, in yield prediction, because we also had plants that were taken up and had more concentration of nitrogen, sulfur in particular. And so that translated to greater yields as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So as we wrap up
these could be like every answer. I'm like, well, there's another, you know, like we're going to need another 45 minutes. Cause it's,
yeah.
I'm going to go I'll let Andrew wrap us up in a second. I completely agree. And then there are times that there are plants that just don't do what they're supposed to do, right? So I can think of a couple products that we've used the last couple of years that would look terrible from the sky. You know, yep. They aren't reflective of how the plant's partitioning and using its energy. And so it would completely fool you, you know, yeah. which is just terribly frustrating because you can't solely rely on that as an indicator.
Definitely. So as we wrap up this part one conversation, Sean, you know, we have all this new technology and I think this whole part one is maybe thinking differently about the technology we use in soybeans. So as we build on, you know, using, you know, NDVI and just we'll say digital imagery, drones, all that stuff, yep. How would you advise growers to start thinking about or using this technology, you know, whether it's drones, NDVI, you know, Centera programs that you can look at, you know, plant stands and all that stuff. How would you advise them to take the next level using this technology in soybean production?
Yeah, in terms of this idea of reflectance or drones or any even satellite for that matter, I mean, you think about, you know, the resolution that comes into this. And again, Sean, this is going to be another talk of its own, right? So within the space, I want to put a pin in this idea of yield prediction. I'm not as concerned about that one, right? What I'm more concerned about is using the technology and active management in the season. And so I think that's where the play is for us as farm managers, as farmers, as scientists, really, is, okay, can we use the drones? And we've seen some of this too. Help document. Let's go with a June stand. I've got another study that we haven't published yet, but we did just a drone with RGB camera, very simple, but looking at canopy closure early on in associations with plant stand and yield. And what we got out of that was that, and again, you guys probably have this appreciation, plant population of soybeans really doesn't matter. It was about what the canopy closure was early on. Do we have enough canopy? So whether it was a stand of 70,000 or a stand of 120,000, it didn't matter. The study came back to say, as long as we had the canopy, the green tissue to harvest sunlight, it didn't matter, right? And so that was one beautiful thing that we got a couple of years ago that still need to publish on. Another aspect is using the reflectance and drones to say, where are their problem spots in the field, right? And this is one I think people can have that appreciation. Is there patterns to that? Use that. And I want to end, because again, I'm going to try to be concise, is be flying late, right? If you're using drones or anything like this reflectance, it seems counterintuitive to be flying at the end of August and early September. There's not much management you can do. I agree with that. But the lessons learned at that point, I think, are huge. And what I mean by that is, all right, I'll go back. This one should be a softball, a toss to you guys to hit out of the park, all right? Precision agriculture, soybeans, all right? You look at a yield map. What does one data point on a yield map mean? It's a 30, 35, 40 foot head now, and then whatever kind of grain flow, right? So you're averaging over 40 feet now. Versus if you go out with a drone flight, you do a stitched image at the end of August and September, you talk about precision, you're going to understand what's different in that field. And so soybeans at that point, when they're starting to senesce, that is a beautiful point to say there's stress points in that field and there's spots that are doing really well. That's the spots I want to go to and understand what's different about that and manage it accordingly. Because when you bring in the combine and it averages over 40 foot, yeah, you'll catch some rough precision yield map, but you're not going to see really what's going on because it gets washed away over 40 foot head.
Yeah. I think that's so really, really great answer. And specifically thinking about as this technology becomes easier to use and we have, you know, it takes less time to go collect that data and sit down and have those conversations. I think it's a great call out and it's an excellent transition because what we want to spend the next portion of our time talking about is really how do we high manage, you know, what does high management in soybeans look like? Dr. Castillo, we'll wrap. Part one, really want to make sure that all of our listeners know how appreciative we are of the hard work you guys are doing. I think about using a monopod in the, in the field and grinding through that, but thank you for that research. And we look forward to discussing high management soybeans.
Yep. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of A Penny for Your Thoughts. Please help us grow our audience by giving us a 5-star rating and sharing our social media on Twitter at Sean Blumgren and at SciPathology. You can also find our episodes on LinkedIn. We love your feedback. Please email us at apennyforyourthoughts@gmail.com. That's apenny4yourthoughts@gmail.com. As always, thank you for tuning in.